Hi, welcome to Breast Cancer Briefing, the podcast where we are breaking down the latest research and science in breast cancer one conversation at a time. And we are at the Miami Breast Cancer Conference at the beautiful Fontainebleau in Miami Beach. And I'm really excited for the guest who's sitting next to me, a friend of mine, that we're going to get into some exciting new data. So she is a breast oncologist at City of Hope. She did her undergrad at UC Berkeley and then completed her MD at UCSF, where I also have ties. She did her residency at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center and then fellowship at USC. They recruited her to stay on faculty at USC, where she got teaching awards for her work with residents and fellows, which is not surprising. And then she joined City of Hope in 2022. She is the medical director of Women's Health Medical Oncology at City of Hope Orange County. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research. So welcome to Dr. Irene Kang. Thank you, Sarah,
for being here.
Thanks for having me. So one of the things just starting out, I love to just kind of give everyone a chance to get to know you a little bit and just share a little bit, you know, more about you and kind of how you ended up in breast cancer. Do you mind sharing a little bit about what led you here?
No, I think it's always really fun to reflect and important to reflect on sort of what brought you here. I think I started medical school really undifferentiated, as we call ourselves sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, cancer and oncology care was not on my radar. But during our early clinical rotations, I was rotating at our general hospital in the surgery rotation, met a patient who had neglected her breast mass for a long time. And so there was a lot of, I think, shame when she came in and fear about her diagnosis and treatment. And just seeing the medical team come through and present a plan of treatment for her to let her know there was sort of hope and a way forward with her care and provide that care was such an experience to walk through as a student. And then every subsequent sort of patient interaction after that, I noticed myself sort of drawn to cancer patients, especially breast cancer patients, because it's a mix of women's health and you see also just the family and the loved ones come around a person. And so to be part of the medical team and support that person through that journey just was incredibly compelling. And I think it was just sort of one thing led to another after that. And I went into breast medical oncology.
I always love hearing like how colleagues ended up where they are. We don't ever get to share that with each other sometimes.
Thanks for asking.
Thank you. I also just have to share a little bit too before we dive in that, you know, this breast research world, it ends up being kind of a small world at times, and you start to cross paths with people at meetings all the time. Sometimes for better or worse, there's a lot of different personalities, but I think Irene and I met. I think we've crossed paths at meetings before, but we really met back in the fall at a meeting in New York. And I think we were seated right next to each other. And it was the first time we really got to chat and connect and just realize, you know, we have kids the same age and just had so much in common. And I think something so special about you, Irene, is that you're just so like warm and passionate and easy to connect with. And so, and you know, we instantly just kind of hit it off and still text. And so,
I'm thinking about you.
Well, thank you. But it couldn't be a more perfect guest of someone that I was like, I have to get Dr. Kang on to talk at Miami Breast. So thank you for being here. Really
excited
to have you
here with you and your viewers.
Thank you. So big topic for us to dive into, triple negative breast cancer. We had a lot of new data, last year come out that is really going to change the way we treat metastatic triple negative breast cancer.
Absolutely.
So I look forward to getting your thoughts on some of that data. Before we get into like the nitty gritty of these trials, would you mind just explaining a little bit, in case someone is not as familiar with triple negative breast cancer, you know, how do we determine if something's triple negative? Like, what makes it unique from, say, other types of breast cancer?
Yeah, it's such a good question, Sarah. I think a lot of times patients or, you know, anyone will sort of, if you Google triple negative breast cancer, a lot of things come up, and usually those things are the most aggressive subtype, worst outcomes and sort of why is that and what is it? So when we have a breast cancer diagnosis, we always have to subtype or categorize that breast cancer as a specific type because it largely determines what we treat that person with, what treatments are effective. And so in triple negative breast cancer, this is a cancer that doesn't express three key biomarkers on the breast cancer cell: the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. So the hormone receptors are negative, the HER2 is negative, and each of these biomarkers are targetable and drive sort of treatment decisions. So when a patient has triple negative breast cancer, historically, the only treatments that have been available and effective in this disease is chemotherapy, sort of an untargeted therapy. And also, unfortunately, in the early stage, risk of recurrence and metastasis is higher. And in the stage four metastatic setting, really outcomes are worse. Survival is worse than other subtypes, perhaps related to limited treatment options.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is for so long, because we have no targets to go after, we always just had chemotherapy. Now for the first time, we're actually getting to start to use different types of treatment,
yes.
Which is exciting. I think one other concept that I would love to just talk about too for more foundation, if you're not as familiar with this, is this concept of PD-L1. It's something that only comes up when we're talking about triple negative breast cancer. Can you share a little bit about what that is and why we care about it?
Yeah, so this was an incredible paradigm-changing, I think, discovery in cancer care and oncology. So before I dive into PD-L1, the idea of using your body's immune system to fight a cancer is often termed as immunotherapy, and it's completely paradigm shifting. Instead of using, you know, an external drug like chemotherapy, really harnessing the body's immune system to fight a cancer. And that was first, I think, really pioneered in cancers that historically have very little effective treatments, like advanced melanoma, kidney cancer, renal cell carcinoma. And one of the discoveries were what's called checkpoint inhibitors. So proteins that can be expressed on the surface of a cancer cell that essentially shut off your immune system. So PD-L1 is exactly that. It's a checkpoint inhibitor, programmed cell death ligand number one. But basically it's a protein that expressed on the cancer. When an immune cell or a T cell binds that protein, it turns that T cell off. So if we can shut off that checkpoint or immune break, then we can keep the body's immune system online and alert, vigilant, and potentially help fight the cancer. So that's been an important area of therapy that's come online for triple negative breast cancer.
Right. And
for some triple negative breast cancer.
Exactly.
Cancers,
exactly. Yes. We really use that as kind of the first, I guess, step when we're thinking about treating a patient who has metastatic triple negative breast cancer. It's kind of the first thing is there PD-L1 expression or not? Because then that's what allows us to use immunotherapy and these checkpoint inhibitors that you explained really well, allows us to use those in treating these patients in the first line setting. The other concept that I want to ask you about that's also new for triple negative breast cancer. So we've always had chemo, touched on immunotherapy. The other new thing are these antibody drug conjugates. That's what we're really going to get into.
Yeah.
We're really excited about these drugs.
I am.
How do you explain antibody drug conjugate to your patients?
So I think historically, well, I start with saying that chemotherapy is just straight a drug in your vein. And what an antibody drug conjugate is a smartly engineered delivery system of chemotherapy. So there's an antibody that can target a protein, and how it's used in cancer care, it's targeting a protein that's preferentially or more commonly expressed on cancer cells, and then conjugating or binding a chemotherapy. So that antibody is bringing the chemotherapy that's attached to it and delivering it primarily to the tumor. And so it's a smart way to deliver chemotherapy. And with this delivery system, you can deliver sort of super therapeutic drugs that you wouldn't be able to give straight through an IV. So it can target the therapy in some ways and also deliver more effective therapy.
Yeah, and we're seeing these drugs really in all types of cancer now. Yes. And then all types of breast cancer. We are also using antibody drug conjugates because of what you've said. They're just more, they give better efficacy. And we've seen really impressive results with these drugs Indeed. In the metastatic setting. I want to talk about the data that came out at ESMO back in October, where we saw two big trials using an antibody drug conjugate in the first line setting for metastatic triple negative breast cancer. So that is really looking at patients, you know, who are newly diagnosed with metastatic disease. We've been using these drugs in the metastatic setting for some time now, you know, in later lines. But now there's really been this push to move these drugs earlier and even give them to patients with early stage disease. But can you touch on, you know, why we want to really get these drugs to be used earlier? Like, why is that important for our patients?
So for metastatic triple negative breast cancer, even when it's, you know, we're in the stages of just starting first treatment, we know that overall survival in this population is not long. On average, it's less than 2 years. And coupled with that, we know that, you know, despite effective first-line therapy or first treatments, some patients don't make it to a second line of therapy, which is scary. And, you know, I think as a provider, as a doctor, I want to do everything I can to make sure my patient can live as long as possible. And that includes, you know, making it to subsequent therapies. The statistic is actually 30% of patients may pass away during their first line, and up to half don't make it to second line. I think perhaps in my practice, probably in your practice too, we don't see it quite that to that level, but I think it argues for putting your best foot forward when you first start off. So starting with your most effective agent to improve overall outcomes.
Right. Yeah. We don't want to lose our patients that early. So if we can give our best drug first and give them more time, that's always what we're hoping for.
Rather than save something for later, right? Because you don't know about later.
Yeah. So I think that's really the general trend that we're seeing in breast cancer in general right now, is you're seeing a lot of these trials moving drugs earlier. So two big trials that have gotten a lot of talk, especially here at Miami Breast. We've been looking at this data again. Both of these trials are very similar. We're going to get into the details, but they both looked at using an antibody drug conjugate in the first line. And in both of these trials, we were comparing this antibody drug conjugate to just standard of care chemotherapy. These trials were for patients who were not eligible for immunotherapy. So that's what we're really going to focus in on, those patients that can't get immunotherapy, usually because they're PD-L1 negative, so they don't have that protein expression that you talked about. Any other reasons that come to mind why we wouldn't give immunotherapy to somebody?
Yeah, you see in your practice? So thinking about how immunotherapy works, we're trying to rev up your body's immune system to fight cancer. Mm-hmm. But our ability to rev up the immune system in a specific way is actually quite limited. And so patients who already have autoimmune disease, or a disease that's driven by immune dysregulation or an active, overactive immune system, are at risk or at increased risk for complications of their autoimmune disease. So for example, if someone has lupus or rheumatoid arthritis and already requires to be on drugs that suppress the immune system to control their disease, giving them immunotherapy could be problematic or even dangerous. The other, I think, scenario that comes up are patients who have previously received immunotherapy, maybe in the early stage setting. And I think, you know, the jury's not completely out on hey, if it recurred after early stage immunotherapy, you can't use it again in the advanced stage setting. But certainly if you had an unacceptable toxicity on previous immunotherapy, like a very serious inflammation of a vital organ like the lungs or the heart, then it wouldn't be worth the risk of repeating immunotherapy.
Right. Yeah, no, that's I'm glad you mentioned that too. In reality, the majority of our patients in the first line metastatic setting, we're not treating them with immunotherapy because there's not a high percentage of patients that do have PD-L1 in the first place with triple negative breast cancer. About 40% or so might have PD-L1 expression. It might actually be lower than that. So for the most part, I think most of our patients, the new metastatic disease with triple negative, where we're going to these antibody drug conjugates. So to get into specifics, okay, the first study was ASCENT-03. So in ASCENT-03, that was looking at the antibody drug conjugate, sacituzumab govitecan or Trodelvy, or we'll all call it SG or SASI.
So many names.
I know, how can we say these mouthfuls all the time? So anyways, you'll hear us throw these terms around, but we should also talk about the fact that SG, the next drug, Dato-DXd that we'll discuss, they're very similar drugs. They're both TROP2 targeting ADCs. So like you had explained, these drugs are both engineered to bind to that same receptor on the triple negative breast cancer cells, that TROP2. So I think that's another reason that these two trials are getting a lot of attention is because they're so similar and the drugs are so similar. So how did they perform? So for ASCENT-03, in this study, again, this was first line metastatic triple negative, ineligible for immunotherapy. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to getting treatment with SG, the TROP2 targeting ADC, or chemotherapy. In these studies, we call it physician's choice chemotherapy or investigator's choice chemotherapy, where it gives the treating physician the liberty to choose like which chemo. And in these studies, or in ASCENT-03, the chemo options are paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, or gem-carbo, which are very standard chemo options. Yes. That we would go to. So do you feel like that was the design? Any thoughts about the design? You feel like it was pretty typical to how we practice?
Yes, I think the design was very easy to say, these would be the other chemos that I would choose if I didn't have SG as a choice.
Yes, yeah, I agree. I feel like for how we practice in the US, those are really our go-to options.
So, yeah, and maybe if we can talk about gem-carbo, what does that mean? That's actually a combination.
Yes, thank you. Yep.
Therapy. So a lot of times in the metastatic setting, we just use one drug at a time because we have data that just one at a time using them sequentially, so one after another, results in the same sort of overall survival as using two drugs at once. But using two drugs at once sometimes can get you a higher response rate. So that's something we might choose in a patient who we're worried might be more resistant, or the disease might be more resistant to standard single agent therapy.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that choice.
Yes, great choice. No, I'm so glad you pointed that out. The other thing too that I wanted to touch on with these studies, or ASCENT-03 in particular, is this idea of disease-free interval. We see that come up a lot in studies like this where it's first-line metastatic. This trial required a disease-free interval of at least 6 months before patients could go on the trial. So that means that patients must have had they must have completed early stage treatment. So, you know, if they got chemo for stage 2 or stage 3 triple negative breast cancer, they must have completed that at least 6 months or longer before they developed metastatic disease. And that can be a sticking point sometimes when we're looking at these trials because we, we hate to exclude certain patients. Right. But what are your thoughts on that? This whole like disease-free interval and do we need it in the trial or not? Because it comes up all the time when we're chatting.
It does, especially, in context of the next study we'll discuss.
Yep.
But, metastatic disease could be you know, at initial diagnosis, when so then you don't even worry about disease-free interval. There wasn't any.
Right, right.
But in the setting of someone who had early stage disease and recurs, there are certain people who recur rapidly or even on their early stage therapy. And there the concern is, I think from a trial design, you know, nothing is, you know, well, not nothing is going to work, but that even a newer agent might have very limited activity in such aggressive disease. And so wanting to limit who gets on study to patients who are likely to benefit.
Right.
So I can understand from a study design perspective why that's put in there. But from a clinical need perspective, it's absolutely the other way around.
Right.
We want to have these options available for the folks with the highest risk disease, the poorest sort of performing, patient outcomes, clinical outcomes. So I feel a little bit conflicted about that. And personally, I wouldn't use this requirement to say, oh, well, if my patient didn't have a 6-month distant recurrent disease-free interval, I don't think I can give this drug necessarily to that patient.
I know, it's such a dilemma that we find ourselves in sometimes we're looking at trials or when we're trying to enroll patients on trials. We'll come back to that too, like you alluded to, for the next trial. But I want to get to the results of ASCENT-03. So what it showed is that patients who got SG, they had an improvement in their progression-free survival by almost 3 months compared to the patients who got chemotherapy. So in the SG arm, patients had a progression-free survival of 9.7 months versus 6.9 months for the patients who were getting chemo. So it was very encouraging that we saw, okay, yes, if we're giving SG first, our patients are doing well longer. And then I want to touch on the overall survival data, which is really, you know, what we try to hang our hat on. The overall survival data is really us following these patients more long term to see, you know, do they live longer by getting this drug first. So for this study, the overall survival data, it's immature. Again, it just means we have to follow the patients longer.
Right,
it's too soon for us to say. So the overall survival data is not mature. So we don't know if there's going to be an overall survival benefit, but we saw this real improvement in progression-free survival. What were your thoughts on these results?
I think it's really so encouraging to see improvements in just how well a patient's going to do on their first line setting. We think that oftentimes it'll translate into a survival benefit, and there are all kinds of difficulties in sort of measuring that survival benefit. Because you can get all these sort of intervening treatments, hopefully, between then. And so I really take that progression-free survival as an important, and it was the primary endpoint. It was sort of what the study cared about in terms of measuring whether there was a real difference or not. And it, you know, unequivocally showed a real difference.
And I want to go back to something that you said. You're saying that there can be real difficulties in showing overall survival benefit, which is so true. There's a big one for this trial that has come to everyone's mind, and it's the fact that patients were allowed to cross over based on the way that SG was already approved for us to give it to patients, you know, in the second line and beyond. The patients who are on the chemo arm, when they progress, they then are going to go on to get SASE in the next treatment line. So that is one of those challenges that can make it hard for us to see an overall survival benefit. Do you have a kind of a better way of explaining like why that is? It's tough because it's like that's the ethical right thing to do for those patients.
That is the right thing to do. Absolutely, I'm so glad you touched on that.
So we are fully agree with that and are happy, but then it can make the results a little more tricky to interpret.
Yeah. I want to say I give so much sort of credit and respect to a trial design like this, where you are ethically providing approved beneficial therapy after first line treatment. So, you know, majority, like 80% plus of patients who did not get SASE in the first line on this study, they were in the control arm, then went on to get an antibody drug conjugate, most likely SASE. Which means then, you know, this intervening therapy, I mean, it wasn't given first, but it was given later line, and the right. benefits that, you know, accrue to that were provided. And so demonstrating then this overall survival benefit, how long patients are living overall, becomes difficult because patients are still getting that sort of special therapy.
Yeah, they're all getting that good drug. Yeah. So it's a good problem to have.
It
but,
is.
We'll come back. I'm gonna put you on the spot a little bit later about the OS data, but I want to talk about the side effects. So the side effects of SG, what are the big ones that we are used to managing in our clinics?
Yeah, I think the nice thing, I mean, it's never good to have bad side effects of a drug, and I think any drug, no matter how benign, can have side effects, we know. But certainly with chemotherapy and ADCs, we've been using SG in the clinic for over a decade now, and or close to a decade.
Yeah, close to a decade. Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy to think about. But it's a powerful chemo that's attached to this antibody. So you can see what's called neutropenia or low white blood cell count. Mm-hmm. Nausea is fairly common, but also in this modern era, we have multi-drug sort of supportive regimens that can really ameliorate the symptoms of nausea. Other than that, you can see diarrhea and fatigue. But a lot of it is not too different from standard chemotherapy in terms of the side effect profile.
Yeah, no, I think you mentioned the big ones. In this trial, in ASCENT-03, absolutely the biggest, most common adverse event with SG that was more with SG than chemo was that neutropenia. Mm. I definitely think that could be the hardest thing to manage for our patients is that neutropenia. And then we have to give growth factor to boost the counts, which can then be an added, you know, step for patients. But thankfully, we have those options to help manage it.
To live safely.
And then, yes, the nausea that you hit on, diarrhea to alopecia as well.
Yes, that, you know, even though we're giving it in a targeted fashion, a lot of these side effects, right, really mirror getting standard chemotherapy.
Yes, yeah. And in this study, the alopecia rates were a lot higher, almost double. It's about 55 percent versus 27% in the chemo arm.
So so good that you bring that up.
Yeah.
That gem carbo regimen that we talked about in the beginning.
Yes.
That regimen is, you know, one of the unique chemo regimens that does not cause significant alopecia. So you know, there's that choice to consider.
Exactly. I know it does matter to patients for sure. Like, can keep your hair longer versus lose your hair.
It's a big deal for many a person.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those are really the big ones. And I think the good thing that we saw in this study is that all of those adverse events, they're all consistent with what we're used to seeing with SG anyway. So we always say there's no new safety signals, you know, no new red flags that popped up, which was good to see. So shifting gears a little bit to a very similar study, we're going to talk about TROPION-Breast02 trial. So again, this is going to sound so similar to what we just talked about. So in the TROPION-Breast02 study, same concept. Patients who were ineligible for immunotherapy in the first line setting, they were randomized to get either datopotamab deruxtecan versus chemotherapy. So datopotamab deruxtecan, that's really like our newest kid on the block, if you will, our newest antibody drug conjugate. But it's very similar in terms of its concept and design to SG. It's another TROP2 targeting ADC. And it also has what we call the same payload, meaning that chemo particle that you talked about that's attached to these drugs. Both of these drugs have a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload. So they sound very similar when you put them on paper, but the side effect profile is really different.
That's
so we'll
true.
Come back to that, but I definitely want your thoughts on the side effects. So again, this study, Dato-DXd versus chemo, the investigators' choice chemo options were a little different in this trial. So we still had paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, capecitabine, which I liked, eribulin, or carboplatin. So not gem, carbo, just carboplatin alone. What are your thoughts on those choices in the control arm in this study?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of choices, and they sort of run the gamut in terms of how I think of how intensive therapy is. Capecitabine is an oral chemotherapy mm-hmm. that can be very well tolerated at the right doses and can be effective, but I tend to think of it as not the most active chemo in this space.
Yeah, I agree.
Whereas eribulin is a very active chemotherapeutic agent in even in triple-negative breast cancers that have seen prior chemotherapeutic agents. So I thought eribulin was a great option to have in there. But as you pointed out, kind of each of these agents was just one at a time. So only single agent chemotherapy were your options here.
Do you use single agent carboplatin?
Really rarely.
I was gonna say, yeah, it's not a really common thing that we use. So it definitely some people were scratching their heads a little bit at that control arm. But again, I mean, it just reflects there's a lot of different practices around the world. This was a global trial. So I still think it makes the results valid. There was some thought that the response rates, which we're not going to get, too into the weeds with that data, but the response rates in the control arm were lower with this study, probably because there wasn't a gem carbo option. We'd love to do that. That combo, like you said, we can get good response rates with that combo. So for this study, another difference was that disease-free interval. Yes. There was no minimum disease-free interval with this study. I know, it was very exciting. Any thoughts on how that might impact results when we see that?
Yeah, so to our point, I think I thought it was a brave decision to make in terms of designing who can go on the study. I think, the concern might have been, oh, you're going to put patients on study that aren't going to respond to anything, even a TROP2 targeted ADC. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about the results shortly.
Yeah.
It looked good.
Yeah, I know. And the fact that, we know the patients on this trial, at least a portion of them did have more aggressive disease that recurred earlier.
Yes.
So it can make the results more impactful, when you think about it that way.
Is, potentially the highest need patients. Yeah. They need the most active drugs. And so I was glad that that population was included on this study.
Yeah, I felt the same way when I saw that. I was really happy to see that. Okay, so to the results. In this trial, we did see an improvement in PFS with Dato compared to chemo by 5.3 months. So the progression-free survival with the Dato DXD arm was 10.8 months. And then the PFS in the chemo arm was 5.6 months. So a pretty big difference there when we saw PFS.
Great to see that.
And then segue over to the overall survival results. I know we said with the ASCENT-03, they weren't mature. We did have overall survival results presented for this trial, and it was positive, meaning that the patients in the Dato-DXD arm, they did have a better overall survival than the patients who were getting chemo. So the median overall survival in the Dato arm was 23.7 months. Then it was 18.7 months for the patients who were getting chemo. So that was a difference of 5 months. So 5 month improvement in overall survival.
Great to see.
Thoughts on how impactful those results are?
I think definitely clinically meaningful benefit in that sort of progression-free survival, so how long someone is going on their first-line therapy. And then to see the overall survival benefit on top of that was just encouragement after encouragement. Mm-hmm. We could talk about, I think this study has had longer follow-up than the prior study we just discussed, ASCENT-03. And then I think a key point here was study design in that crossover that you talked about before was not baked into the study design
right.
for TROPION-Breast02.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm glad you pointed that out again. I think it's, and it's not a bad thing. At this point in time, we didn't have any other approvals for Dato-DXD. So we didn't know if they were benefiting.
So
we don't want to cross people over to a drug if we don't know for sure yet that it
that's
it works,
right.
Which was not the case with the SG study.
Right.
So Yes, definitely a big difference there. Other big difference, toxicities. The toxicities with Dato-DXd are so different than Saci, even though on paper they seem like such similar drugs. Have you used a lot of Dato-DXd yet in your
practice? I have at this point. Okay. Well, I could say I've used enough to be very comfortable using it, and I feel like I have a good sense on how most patients are going to do in terms of side effect profile.
So what are the big ones?
I think there's a huge learning curve with getting acquainted with Dato-DXd
and its
side effect profile.
Agreed.
So I think key things that came out with this study, as well as other scenarios that Dato-DXd has been used, is that it can cause mouth sores or what's called stomatitis, as well as these sort of eye side effects that are mostly dry eyes, but can be like inflammation of the sort of eye layers of the eye.
Yeah.
So conjunctivitis or keratitis. Yep. But the mouth sores thing, honestly, is a big deal if you aren't able to successfully prevent it. You know, if you've ever tried to like eat with a raging cold sore, imagine having many, many of those inside your mouth and trying to just eat or drink something. So that's not a side effect we've seen with breast cancer chemotherapy in a long, long while, I will say.
So it was true.
Kind of, you know, so to get on top of that, you have to prevent it. You can't let it happen in the first place. Mm-hmm. And the good thing is we have preventative strategies for the mouth sores, as well as just to prevent the eye side effects.
Yeah, I think the great thing that I love about this drug is it really doesn't cause those cytopenias, like the low white cells that we have to deal with Saci. It's really not an issue, just like low rates of neutropenia and cytopenias with this drug. So that's great, and great for our patients. Don't have to worry about getting growth factor. But the biggest, the most common treatment-related adverse events in this study were the dry eye, stomatitis, nausea too.
Yes, that can still be a big one. I think all the ADCs so far that we're using.
Yes, absolutely.
Common.
I think we're pretty good at managing that and are all pretty comfortable as providers managing that. But yeah, the dry eye and stomatitis, like you said, those are not typical things with chemo that we are used to managing anymore. So they do require preventative, or what we call prophylaxis and prophylactic medications to prevent that. And it's, it can be a hard thing for a patient to take that on. I mean, you know, when you're busy and you're working all the time, to have to remember to do things to prevent it. So for the stomatitis, the recommendation is that patients use a steroid mouthwash 4 times a day.
Yeah.
And then for the dry eye, it's recommended that patients use a preservative-free lubricating eye drop 4 times a day. So, I mean,
yeah, that's more challenging than, you know, 3 square meals.
It's a lot. It would be a lot for me to remember. So I think trying to help our patients find ways to manage that, like set alarms on your phone or, you know, whatever it takes to remember that. Because, yeah, preventing it is really the key. It can be harder to manage those toxicities once they start. I think, thankfully, too, in terms of the toxicities on this trial, the grades of those toxicity were all low. There were not a ton of like grade 3 or higher toxicities, which means that those toxicities the patients were experiencing tended to be more mild. So at least that's encouraging. And I find that's true in practice. You know, the dry eye, the stomatitis, it, you know, we don't want it to happen at all. But if it does, thankfully, it tends to stay mild.
Largely recovers too.
Yes. And same thing for the dry eye. Anything messing with your eye is very concerning, I'm sure, for our patients. But thankfully, the dry eye, usually mild, and it is not permanent. We see it resolve with drug discontinuation, which is great. So we're not worried about really any permanent eye damage from the drug. The other thing too is, because of the risk of these ocular adverse events, it's recommended that patients get eye exams at the time, like either before or
around
the time of starting treatment. It can be with an ophthalmologist or an optometrist. Like, you can go to anybody. And thankfully now there's some some handy guides that are available for us as providers to give patients to take to their optometrist for a quick baseline eye exam. So kind of another step, but I think it's so important for them to have that baseline.
Yeah, and I've sort of come around to think like, oh gosh, I got to like plug them in with another person.
Yes.
I have to like send my patient to another, you know, appointment when they're already probably so busy. But I've also sort of reframed it to be like, well, I can also support overall eye health by plugging them in, making sure they're seeing an eye care provider. So, you know, it hasn't been as much of a barrier as I initially was afraid of.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think, you know, being able to use just, you know, your optometrist is totally appropriate. And having spoken with some of our ophthalmology colleagues who, you know, helped on these trials and with drug development, there's completely reasonable that an optometrist can handle these really mild toxicities too, which is good. And then usually our optometrists, they already have a referral pattern to get patients to an ophthalmologist if needed. So I feel very comfortable with that. We've gone through, you know, some of the details of these trials. So ASCENT-03, we see PFS benefit with SG. We don't have overall survival data yet, and unclear if we will, given the crossover in that study.
Good points.
And then Nowotropin and Breasto-2, so really great PFS benefit, and we see an overall survival benefit. What are your thoughts going forward in practice about which drug are you going to be using in the first line?
It's the hot topic of the moment in our field, and I think it's because everyone wants to do what's best for the patient in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so it's so easy when there's only one choice. But now we have at least two. Mm-hmm. And I think it's always good to have choice. There are a few differentiators between these two drugs in terms of schedule. So how often you're coming in for infusions.
Oh, yes. We did not talk about that. Yes.
Which
Thank
we
you.
Can, you know, chat on now, as well as how long the infusion itself mm-hmm. takes. So that's always a valuable thing to consider. I'll just launch into it.
Please do.
SG or sacituzumab govitecan is given what I'll call 2 weeks on, 1 week off. You're coming in 2 weeks in a row, and then you have a week off. And the infusions, I think in sort of the standard case scenario, are about an hour and a half, mm-hmm. And that's what you do every 3 weeks, potentially in many cases, the need for growth factor in between cycles to keep your white blood cell count up. Mm-hmm. Datopotamab deruxtecan is given just once every 3 weeks, so 1 week out of every 3 weeks, and the infusion in the sort of best case sort of maintenance scenario is, I think, only 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So shorter.
Yes, shorter and less frequent.
But you have to be doing your mouthwash 4 times a day and your eye drops 4 times a day, like the whole time in between cycles.
Yes, there's trade-offs. Yeah,
and no contact lenses.
Yes, we didn't say that either. Yes, thank you for bringing all of those up, because it's such a real thing that we got to talk about with our patients. Do you feel like there is, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but
we have to go there.
Do you feel like there's a difference in efficacy between these two drugs?
Yeah, I kind of hemmed and hawed about this. We didn't really look at it because it wasn't a primary endpoint, but if you look at response rate for datopotamab deruxtecan, it was slightly higher than with SG, but also interestingly, right, the control arm in the Tropion Breasto-2 study did worse than the control arm in SG. The duration of response is the same, so how long patients went on their TROP2 targeted ADC was really the same. And then that disease-free interval of 6 months included versus not was also different between the studies. So I think I've come away with, I don't really think there's a true activity difference between the two agents. And I've mostly been selecting based on just side effect profile and sort of what schedule makes the most sense for the patient.
Yeah.
But I think some people are waiting for more data.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think, we have data for these drugs too in hormone receptor positive breast cancer, which we didn't talk about that, but, Yeah, the efficacy and the results in that space were a little different, where we saw OS benefit with SG, but not with DAPO-DXT.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I feel the same way. I don't think there's really a big difference in efficacy between these two drugs. I feel comfortable using either one. And it's like you said, it's just a discussion about, you know, the schedule, toxicity, you know, what is going to make sense for that patient. So it's good. Good thing to have more options than less, but it can make it a little more challenging to talk through everything with the patient and make a decision that feels like a really big, scary decision for a patient. So, we'll see with
we
more
will
data.
See.
Yeah. Also, we should say that these drugs don't have official FDA approval yet.
That's
in
true.
The first line setting. So
they are in our Comprehensive
yes.
Cancer Network guidelines.
Yes.
Which also inform a lot of how providers will prescribe. But it's a good point. They're not FDA approved yet.
Correct. Have you had any issues getting these drugs approved for patients in the first line setting because of that?
I have not, actually.
Yeah.
I would say from recollection, when I'm using them in the first line setting, it's unfortunately been in the setting of a recurrence from early stage disease. So then you have, I think, even more of a rationale for switching to an ADC because you've already tried chemotherapy, at least in early stage mm-hmm. disease. But thankfully, I haven't had an issue for access for my patients.
That's really good to hear. I know, I feel like it can be so hit or miss. You
yes.
just never know. And I always have to tell that to my patients too. I'm like, this
we're
is the data and what we're gonna try to do, but sometimes we're at the
mercy
of insurance.
I think a really important point to say, let's say you went with SG first, doesn't mean you can't do Dato-DXd later, even though
absolutely.
The studies were in the first line.
Absolutely.
You could, you know.
Yeah, and we absolutely do that. Yes, I totally agree. We would use both for our patients,
yes.
for
Maybe
sure.
not one after the other, although, again, this is a hot topic of debate.
Oh, yes.
But at least there's still options.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. Well, any final thoughts before we wrap up of anything we missed or...
I just want to say thank you to you, Sarah. I think this is such an important topic that we're discussing and such an area where we need to have breakthroughs like this and then the next one come. And so we're never complacent with the breakthroughs, but we also, of course, celebrate and just like eagerly welcome them to use in the clinic.
And thank you for coming on and talking. So excited to have you. Always love to chat with you and hear your thoughts. So thank you again for being here, Irene.